Hello and welcome to another episode of Lunch with Leon. As you've probably worked out, we've been on our summer break since we had our wonderful show a couple of months ago back at Farnborough. But we're back now with a series of wonderful guests to join me for lunch from around the world of transport. So my guest this time is Alex Hornby. He's the chief executive at Transdev Blaisfield. He's been doing some wonderful things up in his bus company, and I wanted to talk to him some more about it. I started off by asking him how things were going.
Right. Well, things aren't going too badly, I would say. I mean, we're getting decent customer recovery. I think we're in a better position than where we were. We actually managed to have 103% of our customers compared to 2019 in the rail strike week, which was good. And actually, we've dipped down back to a sort of a resting place of around 95%. So that, for me, is one of the key bellwethers about, you know, what we're doing is right. As you know, there's lots of challenges around that in terms of driver recruitment, in terms of inflationary pressures. But for me, if you know your customers are coming back to you and still want to get on your buses, yes, something's going right. That's the reason we get up in the morning, really. And I think when we look at our recovery compared to others and compared to other sectors particularly, I think that proves that in spite of all the things that are happening around us, the customers are coming back. And that, for me, starts me off in a good mood every day.
Yeah, but one or two people are telling me that that's a sort of deep average and there's a big difference between the old peak and the new peak, and the old concessionaries and the new concessionaries and the leisure and the non-leisure. Is that all true with you?
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of things, as you say, behind that. I mean, the peaks aren't what they were, but I think we can use that to our advantage. As you know, your PVR was driven by having to invest a lot in the afternoon peak and the morning peak, and that is less of an issue. So I think as we get back to a truly normal set of timetables, which we will inevitably once BRG, the last amount of government grant funding, ends, I mean, I can see us being able to deliver same kind of frequencies we're offering customers, but probably with less buses because we won't need as much resource in the peak hour. So I think that we can use to advantage. And I think it's good to sort of level out your customer portfolio a bit. Okay, you could argue leisure, you're not getting necessarily the same customer on your bus every day in the way you would a commuter. But I think for me, the commuter and the working from home bit is still yet to fully mature in terms of, I still think there's going to be more people coming back to commuting. I think we just need to ensure that it's motor traffic that we don't want coming back at the peak hours, isn't it, really? So I think we're there ready to serve it. And as you know, we try and do lots of different targeted marketing to appeal to all customer sectors. That's the game that we're in now. I think different types of targeted marketing in a very local way, there's much of need that forever because we do need to talk to different sectors in different ways at the moment to get people's confidence back. And because they're using the bus for different reasons than they may have been doing before.
No, I get that. And I guess I'm worried because the government has helped us with a bit of a car-led recovery, haven't they? And the car is a sort of lower risk commuting tool than public transport. So people who are starting to feel like going back to work have taken some protections by being in their car. And then if you add on to that these fabulous incentives you get for having an electric car, it feels to me like we've been fighting with one arm tied behind our back.
Yeah, no. And I think you're right, we have. I think that the messaging as well that we saw wasn't very helpful. I mean, we did a hell of a lot of work to combat that messaging that I think we managed to almost drown it out a bit. And I think that's why some of our recovery has been quite good and relatively quick as well. But I think from what we're seeing now, I mean, we're in the process. We will have a £2 flat fare coming up in West Yorkshire. We'll have similar in Greater Manchester. So I think whilst you're right, that's all happened, I think it's up to us now to grasp the positive. And I think if that comes to fruition, which I think for me tells me that the DfT number 10, our minister, actually, they do actually want to help us. So I think in spite of what you're saying, I don't disagree with that. I do think there are positives there and there are people who get it and want to support us, and it's up to us to grasp that and move with it. And I know there's lots of questions about, well, okay, £2 fare, that it will present challenges, maybe it's great. I think we need to embrace it, and I think we should see that as a volume driver. And then what happens after that is up to us, really. If we can't get hold of those customers that come to us and keep them and find ways to communicate with them, then we've lost really there. And I think that it's up to us to grasp it as an opportunity and not be led by the problems and pitfalls and disadvantages and what happens next. Well, actually, it's a volume driver, so let's use it for what it is to keep those volumes after it.
And there'll be some journeys that'll be very attractive at £2, won't they?
Yeah. So some of ours in particular, I mean, as you probably know, you know, we go from Leeds to Scarborough. I mean, so I think I would be a little bit more nervous if this has been promoted over the summer. I really worry how many people I'd get queuing up at York Station to go to Seaside and things like that. But again, you either see it as an opportunity or not, don't you? And I think if someone's willing to put quite a bit of funding into the industry, and again, this is totally aimed at the customer, isn't it? For often we see lots of funding mechanisms, and particularly ones that we've seen yet that have been great for keeping the industry afloat. But this is, I think this is the thing that really excites me. It's total customer benefit, this. And it's given us an excuse to give out a really positive message, whereas lots of stuff we've had before, which has been vital for keeping the industry afloat, it's been almost backroom stuff, hasn't it? It's been stuff that no one has any visibility of, no one wants to, whatever. But actually, this is real front of house, strong positive messaging that I think should be great for us. And as you say, thankfully, we've still got quite a lot of capacity that we can use up there with a fail like this. We're looking forward to it if it all comes together.
Yeah, and I sort of cast my mind forward to the end of it, because at the end of it, nothing to stop any of us doing some other sorts of deals, maybe not at £2. But we can capitalise on the retention. We're not compelled to go back to the old fares afterwards, are we? We can taper that off. And frankly, if we've generated some demand and it's still growing, we might keep it going. We might have to tighten it a bit in order to make sure the long distance stuff. But nothing to stop us continuing to play with it.
No. I mean, we came up with a £1 after 7 p.m. fare, as I know a lot of other operators did, when we were trying to recover in the end of lockdown 2020. You get confused as to where these lockdowns were, don't you? And actually, that's still there now, because we haven't felt compelled to get rid of it, because it's grown demand for, as you say. And we said, actually, we're still in the game at the moment to driving the volumes up rather than actually trying to capitalise on a fare increase, let's say. So I think it's exactly that same kind of mentality, is that it'll teach us things about what customers are attracted to. It'll teach us some things about what fares work on certain routes, certain times of day, or all sorts of things. That, yeah, if people are worried, the one thing they shouldn't just do, as you say, is introduce the old fare table back again, because I don't think that'll cut it.
Well, I'm afraid it will just create the wrong impression, won't it? It'll just be
absolutely wrong.
And the purpose of any sort of special offer like that is to learn the things that you would have either had to cost yourself a lot of money to learn with the cost of it. And having learnt it, see how you can optimise it so that you come off at the other end with more ridership.
To be fair, we haven't said it a lot lately, but I remember when I was growing up into the industry and reading the likes of what you said and David Leader said and Ray said and Roger said and all Brian and what everyone said that I was soaking up, you know, was this thing about retailer. Everyone who's going, we're a retailer. Sadly, people don't seem to be saying that a lot lately anymore. But we're a retailer, aren't we? So if we can't take advantage of that and what a retailer would do, we really need to give up and go home, I think.
Do you know, that to me is the greatest sadness of the recent years, is that we never shook off being a utility. People think of us like electric and gas and water, and they just turn it on and it works. And we were never brave enough to be a proper, proper retailer. For me, it's interesting, and I've debated this with people. Nobody's suggesting that British Airways should be nationalised. Nobody suggests that British Airways has got a Commonwealth duty to fly to places in the empire to wave the British flag. British Airways only flies to the places where there are enough people who want to go there and who are prepared to pay the price in order to do so. So British Airways is a proper, proper transport retailer. And I think we lost that battle. And of course, it's been a slow one. And it's the same with rail. There is this thing about it being a quasi utility. It's your rights. It's your right to mobility. The state should pay some or more. And you end up with, as we've given ground and given ground, we're now so regulated that we're no longer deregulated. And as a result of the amount of public money that has gone into the system, then there's no way we can even think of ourselves as a retailer. And I'm sad about that, because I'm pretty sure if we'd embraced being even more of a retailer than we ever were, and you have done as far as you can, Martin similarly has done where he's been. A few people have tried to be real retailers, but I'm afraid in the eyes of the public, we're part of the council, aren't we?
I think you're right. I think it's right in any areas. I mean, I would still defend our position up here, that if you came up here, you'd get a sense that we were a bit more of a retailer. I think you're right, though. I think as a whole, the national image is a bit that. And I think sometimes certain other operators don't help deal with that image, if you know what I mean. I mean, that's why the ones that truly believed in retail are also the ones that truly believe in local branding and the things that happen in retailers. I mean, I still say that how we operate this business is very similar to what you say about the British Airways model. We run where we think we can get a commercial return. We try to do a bloody good job in doing that. And there's a fair price that we charge. We're not here to be the cheapest. We're here to be good value for money. And the way we train our colleagues and the way I communicate to stakeholders is that when people give us their hard-earned money, we want them to feel as good as when they give their hard-earned money as when they put it over the counter in a bar or in Betty's tea shop or in a nice restaurant or whatever, or in John Lewis. And I think still we've still got that kind of mentality. And I think I never want to lose it in my career, no matter wherever we end up working or whatever model it may be. And I think the place where we really need to go, and we've been trying to do this all along, but particularly now where I think there is an opportunity within enhanced partnerships and there's an opportunity what the National Bus Strategy gives us, is with the good local authorities who do seem to get it, is actually this is our skills and investments and what we're prepared to put in. And this is the vision of what the local mayor wants or whatever it may be. And actually, let's sit around a table and do this together. I hate this because I worry I'm trying to make it sound like it's groundbreaking, but it's not really. You know, we sat down and designed the Keithley Network, the centre of the universe is Keithley, where we and the local authority designed it together. And it's a bit cheaper for us to operate. It's therefore a bit cheaper for the local authority to fund. But actually, out of it, we double three frequencies because we just sat there and banged our heads together and said, well, what do you really want? Do we really want to go there? Do we really want to do that? And we actually managed to hide a very, very tiny bit of bad news where very few customers were implicated with great news. And actually, that was because we both respected what each other's position and what we're there to play. And we both wanted to make a difference. We both saw it as our responsibility that we should do something about all this. And I think for me, that's where the opportunities present themselves next, because you now legally can have these conversations. And as operators, you can now be honest with each other about what networks are going to happen next and what's the fallout, what's the opportunity for others. I think there's opportunities there. But again, to do its full potential, back to where we started, you've got to then think, well, I'm a retailer now. So while the local authority is supported, we're in a partnership. Actually, how do I really maximise this? And that's when we have to put our retailer hat on.
Yeah. No, I get that. And what's the competitive landscape? Have you got a lot of private hire minicab activity on your territory? Does that hurt?
We have, ironically, in Keithley, but it's the traditional kind, shall we say. So it's a town of less than 90,000 people, but it's got about 10 minicab firms.
Right.
And it's all low-end, guaranteed fares to estates that are really difficult to compete with price-wise because they're all in a race to the bottom. Sure. I would say the kind of TOD stuff that we're used to in other big cities, that's less of an issue for us. I mean, where we go into the big cities where Uber is a bit more prevalent, probably less so than probably what it was, to be fair, is where we're generally interurban. So it's very difficult to compete with that anyway in terms of price. So that concerns me less. But I guess it'd be great if we had quite decent quality competition in that area, because I'd be much more minded to work together. And even though we're very enthusiastic about what we do and promote ourselves as much as we can, you know, we want to be the mode of choice and all that, we do also accept that we're not always going to be the mode of choice. So it is how you work together in amongst these things, how you create this mobility ecosystem of bringing it all together. My dream is on our interurban routes, you know, I want bus stops that are like tram stops. I want interchanges where people park their car, park their bike, park their scooter, park their whatever, and then continue their journey into the city centres by bus, which helps us therefore drive above frequencies and we're the trunk provider. But actually, the difficult first and last mile bit is dealt by someone who can do that better than we can. You know, we're mass transit, so let the others who don't do mass transit be the non-mass transit bit that deals with feeding them a good, frequent, quality bus product. We dream a lot and we try to put a lot in our bus service improvement plans in that, you know, around that. You know, that's how really we see the big things the local authorities can bring to the party is thinking like that. I'm really impressed by what TransLink do in terms of park and rides on bus routes. And I've been trying for the past 7 years here to try and plonk that on some of our interurban routes, even cleverly as well, when, you know, sometimes it's the bus depot as well that happens to be a car park. You know, I think it's so clever. And I think it's a shame we often think of park and ride in such a traditional and therefore very expensive sense in our part of the UK.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And I think we have, in many parts of the country, the war with the private car and indeed the war with minicabs and so on is a them and us. Whereas, in fact, the intelligent answer is to go work with the grain and accept there are some jobs they will do and some jobs that we'll do. How do we get everybody traveling using the right one at the right time is clearly the right answer. And I can understand entirely why when you come out of a restaurant at 10:30 at night as a two or a threesome, you might choose to get a private hire car back to where you live because it's door to door. May or may not be a bus. It may or may not be in half an hour and it doesn't go to your door.
But hopefully we might have brought you in.
And we might have a deal with the cab company that does the other half of the journey.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think it's just accepting our role. You know, our role is mass transit, isn't it? in some way, it sounds low quality. I'd never use it as a branding term, but like, you know, that's what we are. I think that's where we're at our best. At the moment, we try and do other things, and I'm not a huge DRT fan. Like, I'd gladly support a partner if they're really keen to do it and quick to do it with, but I really, really don't get it. The model's the wrong way around. The funding element of it compared to the revenue element is the opposite way around to what it should be. I get very confused about the enthusiasm for it.
Frankly, some of it's this sort of dinky little bus type image. But the real truth, as my old boss used to say, it suffers from horse bus economics, which is when you're busy, you've only got 10 seats. And when you're quiet, you've still got to feed the horse.
Absolutely. Well said, yeah.
And the trouble with DRT, and Roger French said on the programme, why people like DRT, apart from it's cute and cuddly, is it involves an app. And people just love to have an app. Because once they've got an app, the world opens. You know, they can turn their central heating on and off. They can turn their lights on and off. They can see how much coal we're burning for the national grid, and they can book their bus. But the problem is the proportion of the cost that is the driver on a little bus is way more than it is on traditional mass transit. I mean, we're not giving away any commercial secrets. We know the cost of labour is about 50% on a big bus. Well, it's like 70% on a little bus. You don't get mini bus drivers on mini wages. They want a decent wage. And if they want a decent wage, it's going to be very expensive. And the only way we can afford to pay what we pay is we have some journeys where there's so many people that we've made a few bob, which compensates to some extent for the journeys in the opposite direction where we didn't have so many people. And the overall thing makes enough money to pay for the system. DRT will never do that.
No, absolutely. And the point is about it as well, of course, is that to get your revenue up so you stand a chance now on that journey of paying for the cost that you say, is you probably have to meander everywhere and inconvenience the hell out of everyone who got on it. So the point when it was actually working as a model is the point when it doesn't work at all for the customer. And again, I struggle to buy into things where it's apparently at its best when it's working worse for the customer. You know, that's the other bit that my brain can't deal with as well. No, so.
I think there's also a misconfusion with the other lots that use those sorts of vehicles, which is the community transport sector.
Yeah.
Anna Whitty was on the program a year or so ago. And there is a case on what the Americans would call paratransit, but on community transport. Yeah. Where people that live alone and where the CT is broadly the only way you get any company, they quite like going to Tesco's buy a cup of coffee because they meet six or seven of their friends on the way. They buy a bag of sugar, have a cup of coffee and come back. And that's 2/3 of their day. And they've connected with some people that otherwise I've seen. But that's not the same as a little bus on some sort of, and I can hear Roger shouting with the app.
I mean, what we're increasingly trying to do with our app, to the frustration, but you know, they get there in the end. You know, we have a decent good relationship with the passenger, and you know, we push and push and push. What we're trying to say with our app is we can't be what we've just said and don't want to be DRT. You know, we don't. That's not our role. But actually, what can we do to make our app feel more in line with how others? I mean, I remember one thing Anthony Smith's Transport Focus saying, like, you know, you should be able to buy a bus ticket as easy as you buy a pizza, and that's one key thing. So make the app easy to buy the tickets in the first place. But what things does Uber do that people seem to like about it that makes them trust it and builds the relationship? I mean, so we're in the process now of when the bus comes along, we want the app to say, your driver's Jeff or whatever, and then tell us how good Jeff is, and then we'll tell Jeff how good he is. And then actually, you are creating this, not just the great relationship with the customer, then you get this nice byproduct of, you know, really good colleague engagement as well. So there are lots of things I think we should still see. What things can the app do that will make people think the bus is as convenient as a taxi, even though it isn't scooping you from your door and dropping you off? If we tell you exactly when it's coming, easy payment, familiarity, we can get a few of those things, but I think don't go the whole hog that you think actually, you know, the app can also do this and change the model.
Alex, I also wonder, all forms of contactless payment, including through the app, but all forms of contactless payment make price less sensitive.
Mm, yeah.
Here am I, a sophisticated purchaser, yet I pay £3 for a cardboard cup of hot water with a tea bag in it.
Yes.
My railway station. And frankly, if I wasn't paying for that contactless, if I was really pulling a £5 note out of my wallet, I'd be thinking, hang about.
You really think about it. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
£3 for a cardboard cup of hot water. And sorry, and a tea bag, where I am now going to do the scientific bit of swishing it about. Then I'm going to put the sugar in. Then I'm going to put the milk in. Then I'm going to throw the tea bag away. And I'm thinking to myself, so why is it that public transport has this problem that people perceive us to be expensive, yet we are absolutely paying outrageous amounts of money. That cup of tea on a mainline railway station can't have cost more than 1 or 2 pence to produce.
To produce, absolutely not, yeah.
So I hope with contactless payment, and especially if we start to get end-to-end journey, yeah, that the price sensitivity starts to fall away a bit and people are just...
Well, I think, I mean, we've had, I mean, not necessarily to explore that, but I suppose, as you can imagine, we are at a point now where the majority of our payments are handled via contactless. You know, I was chatting to a driver paying him the other day and he paid in about 30 quid cash. And the rest, thankfully, there was more he did that day. But there was about 400 through a contactless. And that's the kind of difference that you get. And everyone can see that now. Now, we've just done a fare increase and we've got a few years to make up from the things we've now got to deal with, you know, inflation and wages and fuel in particular. And so obviously I haven't told the world this in this way, but some of our fares, you know, we've put in, it's as high as 8% in some cases, 8-10%. No resistance at all. Customer numbers have carried on growing. Now, how much of that is people think, well, everything else has gone up, so it's okay? We've got some people who haven't got a choice, and that's why I still believe you have to do a good job, because some people haven't got a choice, so you've got to do well. So there's some people there. But most people now are paying by contactless. So how much of a role did contactless play in helping to not resist that price increase compared to previous years? It must now play a role, mustn't it?
And thank goodness we've got away from doing the equivalent of Tesco putting a sign in the front window that says, from next Sunday, all prices up 10%. Yes.
Revised fruit fares in operation.
Yes. Right. I mean, at least we can, with contactless, we can play lots of tunes.
Yeah.
And again, I have this debate with people from time to time. I'm told that passengers like the certainty of fixed prices. Hmm. But the same passengers go shopping in supermarkets where the price of fresh food changes by the hour.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. And in the same shop chain across the road.
Yeah. Completely. And so people deal with flexible prices in retail. You know, bananas are cheaper in the afternoon if they've got a lot of them to get rid of. Mm. So people are sophisticated purchasers and they are making some choices, and I think they're capable of making some choices. And I hope we never think that our passengers are too daft to understand, because I think they understand really well.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and we treat them with respect and treat them as intelligent people and give them the best deal we can when we can.
So. Yeah. Well, and I think as well, we understand them well, particularly on a bus. I mean, I've never understood why we aren't as clever as that. I mean, so we've done this stuff in the evening because we know no one was traveling in the evening when we were coming out of the pandemic, primarily because the pubs had just opened and et cetera. People weren't keen to go out, all that sort of stuff. But yeah, we've never been, you know, we've tried things like one of our interurban routes, it's £1 on a Wednesday. Yeah, we tried that and actually it was quite successful. And then the pandemic actually stopped us and we had to be a bit boring for a time. Mm. But, you know, it's things like that where we've got the capacity there. It's there. Why do we have to feel that we need to charge everyone the same amount as when it's busy? And then there is that flip side as well, that actually we end up charging people the highest amount when it's probably the most uncomfortable. We charge our peak time customers, notwithstanding what we said about peaks at the start of our chat, is the customers who often pay the £40 a week, in our case, often are on the full buses, yep, whereas actually the ones who pay less. And so there is a bit of that that I think we probably need to find ways of being better at. But certainly when we've got the spare capacity, we need to be much more cleverer about how we can maximise the return and give better deals for customers to travel at different times. But yeah, and not just do what we used to do, which is having peak fares. I don't think that's quite the answer either. I think it's, you've got to be a bit clever on that, haven't you?
So. I reckon. So we're going great guns here in London with zero emission. We've got electric, we've got hydrogen. How's things with you?
So I think we're excited about electric. Amazingly now, it's about 4 years ago, we introduced the first set of opportunity charge electric buses in the country on our Harrogate network. So it was a whole network, so that was quite exciting. We really like opportunity charging for the application there. It was a town network. So the buses come in and out, charged whilst the customers are getting on off and do a 40-minute round trip and then back they come. And you get this really great visual, because one of the things that is a bit disappointing about electric buses is they're not visual, are they? If you know what I mean, they're still, most of them look the same as the diesel buses they replaced. Again, you know, that doesn't quite make sense. But yeah, so we've got these quite attractive pantographs, if you like your pantographs, in Harrogate bus station. But it's a visual thing. So everyone in Harrogate knows the buses are electric. So we've learned a lot. And I think that was one of the key drivers behind the DfT awarding us, because it was something quite different to what us were doing. So obviously, fast forward to now, obviously, technology has improved. Battery technology has improved. So We've got 71 electric buses coming to us as part of successful Zebra funding alongside North Yorkshire and West Yorkshire. So that's quite exciting. Full conversion of Harrogate depot to zero emission electric. Full conversion of our depot running our network of airport services at Leeds Bradford Airport, and the conversion of an interurban route between Bradford and Keighley. So yeah, that's quite exciting. And I think, as ever, the electric bit is exciting and has its role to play, as we know, for all the great reasons, decarbonisation, et cetera, et cetera. But again, it's that excuse and that driver it gives to say the marketing opportunity, the community engagement, the fact that the bus is setting the example on the road with this, and how that gets people interested in buses. And that was the thing that really excited about us when we introduced the first set of buses on Harrogate Electrics, is people in the town started talking about buses a lot more and were interested and intrigued. And, you know, the business community, the retail community, the hospitality community, all of a sudden you could say, can I come and talk to you about electric buses? And they'd want to speak to you now. And the thing when I know that you cracked it is when you look down estate agents' lists and it says, this house is on an electric bus route. And you're like, really? Yeah, we've got it. Really? We've got it.
Oh, that's good. That's good. That's your equivalent of living on Crossrail. Yes, that's
yes. Yeah.
Isn't that good? Look, here's a curveball for you. What advice would you give my successor in TfL as to where to go with the bus network in London?
Well, and I think, and I was reminded by this because the last time I actually spoke to TfL in any formal degree, it was because they wanted to talk about branding and what to do about express bus services. And actually, yes, they're the two things that you think, well, what works for us up here that we place a lot of value in and appears to drive customer growth by any data you choose to use, it does have a role to play. You know, friendly drivers delivering attractively branded products that customers understand, and ideally, how can you make the best of the road network that you've got in order to deliver fast, attractive bus services, which is, you know, it's all obvious, remember. And I think that's often the bit that's missing. London has a great system in the main, you know, thanks to the work that you and others have done ahead of us. But you do think there are things that often that we do in the provinces that could be very easily replicated. Then again, I'm sure all we do is probably things were replicated elsewhere before. Indeed, maybe even London 30 years ago, what have you. So lots of it isn't about reinventing the wheel. But yes, the kind of things I miss as a customer in London is, I'm sure there are better, quicker ways you could connect key places. I'm sure there's ways that could be done to improve the specification of the vehicles themselves, which I know that is being worked on now, and that's great to see that that's now been acknowledged. And again, the ease of information as well. I think, you know, we still believe in both using technology to drive information and open us with customers, but we still also believe in high quality information at roadside, paper timetables, real human beings to talk to customers and those type of things. And I think there seems to be a bit of a slip in things like that lately, but, you know, hopefully these are the things that are being picked up. But there's plenty we've still got to be jealous about London, particularly in terms of how road space is given to buses and those extra things that happen, frequencies, the fact it's just in the culture, you know, that are all those things going for it. And again, that's why a lot of these things, they're the, almost the extra bit at the ends that would really amplify the system.
I was really disappointed we never got anywhere with the route branding, because, you know, you've demonstrated it, Martin demonstrated it, and others. Actually, the route branding that we did in London was pretty low key, really, yeah, compared with what is capable of being done. And in fact, I just saw one of the last remaining route branded buses with most of the route branding half off earlier. Yeah. But we are quite lucky. So the new bus director in TfL, Louise Cheeseman, you know, she came from Hull Trains. So yeah, she's a retailer. You know, she
was
an access train operator. She's interested in selling tickets. So she's very keen to push the retail side and get more people to travel. And I think also we were able to have relatively simple route networks with end-to-end services, 24 hours a day, etc., when the money was good. But there comes a point at which you can't always afford some of that. It feels to me, I was in Hayes the other day where the X140 runs. And frankly, the difference between the two is nowhere near as good as it should be. They're hardly distinguished on the bus stops. There's certainly nothing on the vehicles maps themselves. And the whole idea of being able to travel more quickly between some of the key destinations, I think, is undersold. And you're always very worried that, in fact, it's being allowed to be like that so that it can go back to being how it was. Because self-fulfilling prophecy that actually it was quite a nice idea, but, you know, it didn't didn't quite work. So I just hope in London, as well as chasing down the bottom line, we can chase up the top line.
Absolutely. And I think you're right. I mean, that's probably the overall thing, is that there is lots of conversation about cuts everywhere. And again, it does worry me when it becomes the key method of conversation. I know sometimes it has to be used as a political tool and things like that. But when you're talking about cuts in the press, no matter what your rationale is for it, buses just sound bad, don't they? You know what I mean? When you ever hear about a company running things down or cutting things, it doesn't really make you feel good about it. And I think sometimes in the bus industry, we get a bit proud about it because we think it's like a power thing, that we can cut things and we've got the power to alter things. And we love it sometimes, don't we? And I just wish that we saw it as the customer saw it.
And also, bright young people don't want to come and work for declining industries.
Absolutely, yeah.
We want to go and work for somewhere that looks like it might go somewhere. So, of course, technology, of course, some areas of retail. They want to go and work for companies where the job is good and where it looks like they might make progress inside the organization. As soon as we say, come and work in our bus company, and by the way, we're cutting the mileage by 2% every year. Well, yeah. He wants to be director of cuts. I just reckon we have to show ourselves. Last thing, Alex, really, how are you for drivers? Because in London, we're turning over 15%. We can recruit an infinite number of drivers, but they only stay 5 minutes.
Yeah, it's a similar challenge here. I mean, pre-COVID, our turnover was quite a remarkable 5% or lower. And we've really got to change our mentality. I mean, we didn't have to advertise recruitment. People came to us. Again, I think the product spoke for itself. So people came to us. But now, yeah. Our driver shortage across the whole business is around 10%, which obviously is not sustainable. We've had to address that by not just wages, but actually, you know, getting decent wage increases through quickly, because I just don't see the point, again, of it being an argument resulting in strikes, because there's clearly a number now that you've got to go for. And I prefer when we negotiate that we just try and get to that number quickly rather than trying to think we've got one over on the union or over on our staff. I just don't see the rationale in that. Nobody wins in that game.
No. If you're not careful, you can spend a long time finally getting to a position with the trade union, which is actually not a good enough position to recruit and retain good staff. In which case, you wasted the whole process, frankly. And we ought to be proud to pay better wages. And I think it comes at a price. And the price is that some people that you might have employed in the past, and I certainly have, would have to sharpen up their act if they were going to be good enough to get paid at all sorts of rates. And I'm talking about accidents, and I'm talking about attendance, and I'm talking about appearance and customer type things. And if I'm going to end up paying £18 an hour or £19 an hour, which might be more like it as a competitive rate down here in London, though some people wouldn't be worth that. But I'm sure there are plenty of people that would be if we gave them the chance.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, we were quite pleased in a way that, you know, our rate in here in Harrogate now is £13 an hour. Right. Pret a Manger here is paying £10.50 an hour. And I thought, well, actually, I like that difference. You know, in some ways, I'm a bit proud that that's the difference.
No. Because frankly, if you work in Pret a Manger and make a mistake, you won't kill anybody. You won't lose your license and your livelihood. You won't get your car driving license taken away. And there's a reasonable chance in Pret a Manger that you might get some weekends and bank holidays off. Whereas, as a bus driver, you're going to be working all the weekends and all the bank holidays, and you're going to be out at 5 a.m. and you're going to be out at midnight. And from time to time, there's a risk you get a punch on the nose. So for all of those things, I think you deserve a higher rate.
Yeah, quite. So I think now that those things are being dealt with in the scheme of things, guess what? Recruitment is becoming a bit easier. And actually, there's nothing more paralysing than not being able to run buses without having drivers. It just stops everything. I do not sit comfortably in the morning or any point during the day if I know we've cancelled buses. It stops you being confident, creative, all of the things that you need to be, I think, to be an effective leader in Orange. You just can't live with yourself when I know I've got people outside the road and the bus not turning up. So you have to solve it quickly, and when you have to do the things that you say to address the recruitment issue. And thankfully, you know, it is turning. Every week is better than the week before. And as I said at the beginning, the customers are coming back, so something must be going right. Yeah.
Well, look, there's a good place to end. Alex, the customers are coming back. That's good. So my guest has been Alex Hornby, who is the Chief Executive of Transdev Blaisfield. It's been really great to have Alex on the show. This is an itthub.net production. Come to our website, itthub.net. You'll see everything there is to see going on in our world, and in particular about our wonderful show at Farnborough each year, in which we bring together the manufacturers, the data handlers, the energy providers, and the disruptors for everything that's modern in all forms of transport. That just remains me to thank Alex really very much for joining me today for lunch, and I look forward to seeing you again soon.